case on calendar is case number 61387, Lender Processing Services versus District Court. Mr. Posenberg, are you ready to proceed?
Yes, sir.
Very well.
Good afternoon, Chief Justice Pickering, and please the court, Dan Posenberg for petitioners. It is one of the basic principles of our government, not just a due process, that we do not let the coercive public power of the state be exercised by private individuals, especially those who have a profit. This has been recognized by the founders of our Constitution, repeatedly by the United States Supreme Court, in 1957 by the Attorney General, and most importantly, by the Nevada Legislature in enacting NRS 228.110.2. So while we may talk about due process, and while we can discuss separation of powers, this case is, above all, one of statutory construction. Let's look at that statute. And you have the handout in front of you. Mine is a textual argument. This statute says, no officer of the executive department shall employ any attorney or counselor to represent the state of Nevada within the state as an attorney for the state of Nevada. It's really quite simple. What it says is, just what it says, no executive officer can hire an outside attorney. That's because it is the responsibility of the Attorney General to represent the state in all these cases.
Well, Mr. Posner, I'm just curious, maybe we haven't had challenges, but I know Jim Gibbons hired Mark Hutchison to represent the state in the affordable health care litigation, and I think we had some tobacco litigation.
The tobacco litigation was a little bit different. The tobacco litigation didn't take place within the state.
Okay.
So we're not talking about those actions violating it. I've been thinking for the last 2 weeks about Mark Hutchison and how he falls under this. If this is the only statute that applies, if there isn't some other statute, I don't think, unless the Attorney General recused herself for refusing to take the position, under this statute, the governor could not have hired Senator Hutchison to do that. But they do note that case in a footnote. They do note the Massachusetts case that says that the governor cannot hire private counsel when the Attorney General refuses to handle a case in very similar circumstances. But this is a pretty, I think this is just that broad. There are only two exceptions to the statute. It's unless the Attorney General and her deputies are disqualified, or unless the legislature specifically authorizes the representation. And neither of those exceptions apply here. Now, the general's textual argument is a little different. She argues that you look at the entire statute, Section 1 and Section 2, and Section 1 says that the Attorney General shall be the legal advisor for all the departments and all the agencies. And the whole argument is that the burden, the focus is shifted a little bit, that other executive officers cannot replace her. But I don't think you read it that way. I think you can read Section 1 to say she shall be the legal advisor, just like Article 5, Section 21 and 22. The Attorney General shall do the activities prescribed by law, and 228.170, to protect the state, an action has to be brought or defended against. The Attorney General shall commence the action for motion of defense. These are non-delegable duties that are placed on the Attorney General. And there's nothing that you can do in a reading of the text of this statute that says that the Attorney General has the option to hire private counsel, where simply other agencies do not.
Except in your interpretation of the statute, where in the statute does your client have standing to pursue this claim?
Standing in this situation, I think, is a simpler situation, because what we're really doing here is raising an issue in the appellate court that was raised in the district court. And what we raised in the district court is that we should not have to, and the Eastern District of Kentucky accepted that this was proper for standing. Now, last month they ruled on the merits differently on due process, but they again affirmed that a party has that kind of standing to raise this issue. So you're not faced with somebody on the other side who is improperly representing the case.
Well, under our normal standing, are you suggesting we have standing under the statute, or are you suggesting we have constitutional standing to make this objection?
And we lay it out in our brief that we don't have to rise to the level of constitutional standing. We're just looking at the remedy that's available for a violation of this particular statute.
Can I ask you, you mentioned that, and the remedy is indicating that any claims for legal services rendered in violation of the statute shall be void. That's the remedy.
And the general does argue that that would have to be the exclusive remedy. But if that were the case, Your Honor, the unauthorized practice of law statute in NRS Chapter 7 only sets out the remedies that the state bar can bring an injunction or that it's a felony. It doesn't say that.
The state bar issue then, as part of their evaluation process under Rule 42. Yeah, as a district court judge, you get these applications for pro hoc vice application, and you get a state bar recommendation indicating, okay, they complied with the rules.
That's enough. Yeah, Rule 42 doesn't set out that you have to look for other violations of statutes that would prohibit it. But you notice when we look at the UPL statute in Chapter 7, it doesn't say that a court has to disqualify an attorney who isn't licensed in the state. So you can't say that exclusive remedies only go to what's set out in the statute. Here, it's a violation of the statute. I think it is clear in cases outside of that, and this court hasn't addressed it, that we would have standing to say, we're being prosecuted by attorneys who are violating the statute, who aren't allowed to practice in this kind of case. The Attorney General isn't allowed to hire them. And as the Eastern District of Kentucky went so far on the standing issue, is to say, yeah, we're asserting bias. We're asserting the fact that there are people who are prosecuting these cases who really shouldn't be able to.
The interesting remedy indicates specifically any claims for legal services or requests for payment. What if they were acting pro bono?
Well, the statute does set out two things. And the Attorney General's opinion in 1957 points out that this statute says two things. One is that an executive officer cannot employ any private attorney and then the green part or be compensated.
Right.
So there are two different things that are prohibited here. And the Attorney General's opinion from 57 sets them out as two separate things. You cannot hire private counsel and you cannot compensate them.
So in order to go back to you shall not employ any attorney at law or counsel at law to represent the state of Nevada. What if it was to help represent the state of Nevada, acting as perhaps co-counsel?
Well, represent is a very, first of all, very broad. Is there any ethics rules? It would be basically any kind of retention where I would be operating with somebody. Represent as an attorney is a little more narrow word, and that means that you're acting for somebody as opposed to simply being a counselor. And here, clearly, when they are being brought in and appearing in court, I don't think under the statute they can even investigate as attorneys. But when they try to appear as attorneys, that's a clear violation of the statute.
Your point is it's really no different than a disqualification. These people are disqualified.
From a standing issue, certainly.
How do you otherwise have standing to come up on writs if somebody's disqualifying somebody?
Right, and that's basically what I'm doing now. What the Attorney General tries to argue is that there are different types of interests, and I don't have any of these interests. They say that I don't have the private right of action, but I'm not suing for damages. It's not a Baldonado type of case, Baldonado 1. They say I don't have an interest in seeing that the state doesn't have to pay. They say that I don't have the right to be free from prosecution. That's not what I'm doing. I'm not asking that there be no prosecution here. Indeed, the Attorney General goes so far as to say even if these counsel are not allowed to represent the state, this prosecution will go forward. My understanding is that they should be disqualified because they violate the statute.
Not unlike if your client had had a formal representation
For the standing issue, I agree. That would give me standing if there were some kind of ethical conflict which would require a disqualification.
And you're saying that the money incentive disqualifies them as acting as co-counsel for the state in this instance?
I'm very much sure on that. I'm saying that the statute precludes them from representing.
I understand it, but I'm trying to address the standing piece of it.
Well, even if that part were in there, if the statute says the attorney general cannot hire private counsel, then that's a violation of that statute, and they're violating that statute in bringing a statutory penalty case against them. And I think that would give me the standing to just keep those counsel from representing against me. Yeah, the attorney general argues that she's allowed to do this under the Constitution, under the statutes, under the common law, but none of that gives the right. Basically, what she's arguing is that she has an implied power to hire private counsel. And Justice Berger, you said, well, they're not representing, they're representing with her. And that is what they argue the test should be on page 42 of their brief. They say that the term of test is whether the attorney general is representing the state. And as long as the attorney general is doing that, then it's fine. But that's not what the statute says. The statute says that no officer shall
employ. It kind of does.
No, but it precludes. What the statute precludes is an executive officer from employing a private attorney to represent the state. The determinative test is whether the private attorney represents the state. There's nothing in this statute that gives them the right to hire outside counsel, even to assist themselves. Yet in the Ryan case, the attorney general argued at the time he had the ability to do things under the common law, and the common law really gave the attorney general expansive rights. This court rejected that notion in Ryan, saying that no, the Constitution sets out the powers and responsibilities, and the Constitution gives no power to the attorney general. It says that all of that has to be established by law, and the statutes have set out what they can do. And just like in Ryan, where the attorney general could not bring an indictment, the attorney general here doesn't have the express ability to hire private counsel. Your Honor, I'd like to save my 3 minutes for rebuttal.
You may do so.
Thank you.
Please support Kevin Benson, Deputy Attorney General, on behalf of the State of Nevada, the Bureau of Pardon and Interest. We found a petition for extraordinary writ to compel the District Court to essentially remove counsel from the underlying litigation in this case. This Court should deny that petition for two principal reasons. First, because the statute does not strip the Attorney General of her authority to hire counsel to assist her in doing her job in litigation that she controls. And second, because LPS has no standing because they have suffered no harm and have no interest in removing counsel in the underlying case. With regard to the statutory construction, they show you this exhibit, a part of the statute, where they pick and choose certain parts of that statute to try and make their textual argument. But as this court is well aware, statutes always have to be read together as a whole, including all of their subsections. And in this case, subsection 1 recognizes the Attorney General as the chief lawyer for the executive branch. Subsection 2 carried out that subsection 1 by preventing other executive branch agencies from hiring outside counsel to replace her. It does not prevent her from hiring the counsel to assist her in litigation that she controls. OPS's interpretation is a narrow interpretation of one part of subsection 2. And in this case, the purpose of that is clear when the entire statute is read together. What we're talking about here is preventing those other agencies that the Attorney General represents from getting around her, from lawyer shopping, from hiring other attorneys and making an answer that they don't like to hear. That's the purpose behind that statute. And as this court knows, the overall purpose of statutory construction is to arrive at what the intent of the statute is and what the purpose is in carrying out that statute. OPS's interpretation conflicts with that intent because it prohibits the Attorney General from doing what is necessary to carry out her duties as a constitutional officer. Additionally, The legislature and the board of examiners have been aware of this interpretation for a long time. As Mr. Pelton mentioned earlier, it's not a secret that the Attorney General has hired outside counsel in the past. The tobacco litigation was the most prominent. Another prominent example is with the Upper Mountain, involving both the litigation and the licensing that goes on with regard to the Upper Mountain. And there was another issue where they hired outside counsel to review antitrust matters with the merger of United Health and Sierra here in Southern Nevada. And the legislature has been aware of this for a long time, starting at least back in 1982. There was an issue that arose with the Hague case, which was part of the same debt from Berman. This came to the attention of the Public Lands Committee of the legislature. In 2007, there was a bill that would have required the Attorney General to make a report to the entire outside counsel. But it didn't pass. In 2011, Senator Raggio had a BDR, the title of which indicated it would have regulated contingency fee agreements by government agencies. And we withdrew that BDR. So the point being, this is something that's been well known by the legislature. It's been on the radar screen for a long time, and we have never taken any action to change what has been a long-standing interpretation of the Attorney General's office of this statute. And furthermore, the Board of Examiners reviews these statutes, and it's specifically charged, reviews its contracts. It's specifically charged under 333-700 subsection 9 with reviewing contracts to be sure that there is adequate legal authority to enter into the contract. The BOE has never rejected one of these contracts on the grounds that OPS not urges. And so the point being, this court should not do as OPS suggests and interpret the statute in a way that is contrary to the way this office has interpreted it, the legislature has agreed with that interpretation, and the BOE has been for at least the last 3 decades.
Can I ask you a question, just going back to the very narrow standing issue? Who would have standing to challenge this? I mean, you claim that they don't have standing here. Would anybody have standing to challenge this?
Well, first of all, we have a rightness issue in this case. Because we're dealing with a contingency fee agreement where there will be no claim for payment of any kind unless and until they're actually recovered by the state. And so until that happens, I'm not sure that anybody has claim. But assuming that was to occur and it were to become law, then at that case, I don't want to speculate entirely, but I think that at that point, perhaps there may be a taxpayer standing in the with the assertion that it violates the statute, that there may be standing by a legislative body. But again, in that case, we're dealing with a recovery that comes from the defendant as opposed to from
the defendant. Let's change the topic, though, and let's say the second sentence was simply, no outside counsel shall be hired by the Attorney General who has a conflict of interest, and that the rest of the statute was all the same, paragraph 1 and paragraph 2 and paragraph 3. Would you agree in that situation that if Mr. Posenberg's client moved to disqualify associated counsel whom he believed had a conflict of interest, that the client would have standing to assert the statute?
I think if they were moving under a regular conflict of interest, they would have standing in the legal role as a professional responsibility.
Okay, then bear with me for a minute. Why should we not take paragraph 2 as a legislative declaration that hiring outside counsel in association on a contingency fee basis creates an incentive that is different from the public incentive that the AG has, and it produces a profit motive that gives rise to an intolerable conflict? Yeah. In other words, that we don't want associate counsel for the AG unless she is disqualified or the legislature has said, okay, in this context, it's okay for there to be outside counsel.
I think we have two issues here first. I think we have a statutory standing issue, and then I think we have a constitutional standing issue. And with regard to the first one, the reason why there's no standing under this statute is because the statute provides for the only remedy, which is that a claim for services in violation of statute is void. And that indicates that the legislature did not intend to provide standing for anybody to assert that just because it's a violation of the statute, you're not therefore able to have counsel removed.
Well, but paragraph 2 says, no officer shall employ any attorney to represent the state of Nevada, except thus and so.
Yes.
So that's a larger prohibition than a limited penalty.
that a liquor will be, that the only remedy, however, is the payment. And so what the legislature intended to do there was not have people running into court to try to say, look, these counsel cannot be had in this case. We want to remove these counsel. Instead, what that does is it tries to catch it on the corner, even if those counsel hopefully will think to themselves, wait a minute, maybe I won't get paid if I do this, so maybe I won't take this case in the first place. And second, if they do go forward with the case, that's the only remedy, because we don't want people running into court to try to get a tactical advantage of disqualifying the other side.
So you don't want a cottage industry of disqualification?
Exactly. And so that's why the subsection 3 is important, because it indicates the legislature knew what it was doing by creating that particular remedy and only that remedy in this case. So that's the statutory standing issue in this case.
Yeah, probably the person or the entity with standing is the very entity that authorized the contract in the first place, the Board of Examiners.
I believe that that may be correct, Your Honor, that in this case they did go to the board and they did approve the contract. So arguably, if there were to be a dispute over that, it should have gone to the Board of Examiners first. In this case, with regard to...
And it's the case, is it not, that the Board of Examiners administratively approve all these contracts?
That is the case, Your Honor.
So if there was a challenge to the Board of Examiners' determination, I suppose there's some process available for someone to file such a challenge, but or have that reviewed judicially.
I honestly don't know that process is off the top of my head. I would assume it would be some kind of judicial review process.
Okay. Could you clarify the procedural nature in which this was tendered to the district court? Did this come up in the context of a Rule 42 association, or?
Yes, it did.
So this was an objection to a pro hac vici admission?
Correct.
Okay.
And so in that context, it's clear that, at least in the district court, it was clear that nobody is disputing that outside counsel in this case are qualified and professional and are otherwise
under Rule 42,
under 42 but, entitled to be admitted.
So there wasn't an objection based on Rule 42.
Okay.
But the objection based on the statute is that you cannot validly appear under a contract of hire because the statute says no officer shall hire outside counsel unless X, Y, and Z is true. And they're saying X, Y, and Z is not true.
That's correct. That's a challenge. It's not under...
So they're saying there's no contractual attorney-client relationship that merits granting the Rule 42 motion, or not.
Would you agree that indicating that any contract that there is would be void under the statute?
And that was the argument in the district court that was rejected.
I believe so, yes, Your Honor.
And then they run it up on a writ that you should not have granted the Rule 42 motion?
That's correct.
Okay.
And so we're here on an extraordinary writ where ordinarily this would not come before this court except under the abuse of discretion, so it's going to be And so in this case, I want to touch base briefly on the more substantive standing issue, which was raised, which in this case, as this court has said, in order to have standing on a writ, you have to show that the writ must be denied, that the writ would be denied unless the petitioner would gain no direct benefit from its issuance and suffer no direct detriment if it is denied. That's the Hill versus Legislature case. And so I don't think it's correct to say that they only want to show constitutional standing in order to have standing in front of this court on a writ. I think they have to show more than that. Because it's one thing to go into federal court and to say, make some allegations that perhaps maybe I've been harmed, but what they're asking this court to do in this case is to say that every time ipso facto Attorney General hired outside counsel, that's a violation of due process. And therefore that gives me standing to come into this case and into this court to get a writ to remove outside counsel. But in this case, all the evidence is directly contrary. This contract clearly shows that it is the Attorney General that is in control of this litigation. It is not outside counsel.
That was an important feature in the Merck 2 decision, I think, disregarding this conflict problem. Is the statute in Kentucky the same as the statute in Nevada?
In terms of associating outside counsel, I don't believe it is, Your Honor. But in the Kentucky case, that was a federal lawsuit that they brought under a due process claim.
Mm-hmm.
And initially, the district court did say, okay, you have standing to bring this claim in the first place, and then ultimately ruled against them on the merits. And those are supplemental authorities that we recently submitted to this case. And, but in this case, particularly, they have to show some kind of harm. They have to show not only just some allegations generally that there might be some due process implications. They have to show that they have or will suffer a due process injury in order to outstanding in this case to try and disqualify outside counsel.
Well, let's test that. Why isn't it sufficient constitutional harm to say I'm being sued by a lawyer who can't, by statute, appear in the case?
That is not a constitutional harm, because, as you know, the Constitution only protects certain rights, and due process in particular only protects the most fundamental of rights under the federal Constitution. And the Nevada statute does not allow us to that level. The constitutional requirements have been set out by several Supreme Courts, particularly the Santa Clara Court and the California Supreme Court. They talk about the due process in particular, and they say, as long as the Attorney General is in control of the litigation, then it's permissible under due process.
Would a defendant in a criminal case have standing to object to the association of counsel by a district attorney to prosecute the defendant for a crime?
On a due process claim, I believe the defendant would have standing to bring that. So, but this is clearly not a criminal case, and all of their insistence that it's a quasi-criminal case does not hold water in this case, because it's clearly set out as a civil case under the Deceptive Trade Practices Act, which is the relevant statute here.
If it were a criminal case, then you would acknowledge LPS has standing to contest the association of an arguably unqualified counsel?
I believe that they would in a truly criminal case, and that is the distinction here, is that this is clearly not a criminal case in this case. And in this case, they were, other than making some general allegations about due process, here they have not shown anything to substantiate that the Attorney General is not in control of the case. And they're going to go up and argue on the better that they're just one little part of this contract. But even taking that, again, to be something of the contract that they've done with the statute, they don't read the entire thing as a whole and look at it as a whole. This contract has actually been cited by a legal scholar as a model for other states to follow, because it goes above and beyond what is required by Santa Clara and the other courts to ensure that due process is guaranteed to defendants in these cases.
Reading Mr. Poulsenberg's mind, what's that provision?
That is we call it the sacrifice provision of a contract, which is the part that prevents the settlement of the case for purely injunctive relief. But it does not in any meaningful way prevent the Attorney General from settling the case, from dismissing it altogether, for that matter.
Well, I thought if there was a settlement, and I could be absolutely wrong, that there was also a provision that reasonable attorney's fees for outside counsel had to be paid. Is that incorrect?
I'm sorry. But
if there was some type of a settlement, that there would be a provision for reasonable attorney's fees to be paid as part of that discussion, I thought I saw something to that effect.
The part that they pursued with states that if there was a settlement of only injunctive relief.
Okay.
Meaning that the defendant in that case would have to agree to pay outside counsel's attorney's fees.
That's what I thought I saw.
And that means the purpose of that is to prevent what's called a pure sacrifice offer, where the defendant pits the plaintiff's attorney against the plaintiff against the own attorney by saying, okay, well, we're going to give you some really substantial, meaningful injunctive relief, but you have to waive your statutory claim to attorney's fees, to statutory attorney's fees. And so we're taking that off the table. And for only thing in the contract that prohibits is that kind of settlement. It doesn't prohibit the Attorney General from settling for a dollar or some other nominal amount that will not produce fee for counsel.
Okay.
So it doesn't mean any meaningful way.
Very narrow.
So it's a very narrow, and that's the only peg that they try to hang their hat on for arguing that this contract does not protect the due process. And that is contrary to Santa Clara. It's contrary to the Rhode Island case and Motor Industries, to all of these courts that have addressed the due process concerns in these cases. And furthermore, I would note that as far as whether the Attorney General actually exercises control over this case, we submitted uncontroverted evidence of that fact, which they have not contested in any way, and that, of course, is reviewed for clear error at this court. So I realize I don't have some time, and I apologize, Your Honor, for these reasons, the reason expressed in the brief, and request that you deny the petition.
Thank you very much. Mr. Posner.
Thank you, Chief Justice Pickering. I don't read Heller the same way. I read Heller as saying that you don't need the per mandamus proceeding to have constitutional interest. We're only talking about a beneficial interest. And here we have that kind of beneficial interest. This is an action against us for statutory penalties. And it's the Deceptive Trade Practices Act, and we've argued back and forth in the reply and surreply briefs about whether it's quasi-criminal. But I would think even in a purely civil action, I have standing to say that the other side cannot hire an attorney on a contract that's illegal. And my standing is all the more acute when that other side is the state of Nevada. This statute says that this contract is illegal.
Mr. Schlesenberg, counsel took on that argument in their response in terms of the statute that you gave us, that if you read the whole statute,
If you look in front of you, you have the whole statute.
Well, I have that statute, but is there another statute that talks in terms of the fact that this was enacted so that other officers or agencies
know? No. In fact, notice they say this was that this statute says that other officers can't replace the Attorney General. Well, the word other does not appear here. And it doesn't say replace anywhere. That's what I'm saying. I'm not usually a textualist. But I here can say, just look at the language of the statute. I win. And they come in with non-textual arguments like the Constitution, but this court says they don't have common law or constitutional.
Constitution doesn't count, Mr. Vesper?
The Constitution does not give the Attorney General any powers, Your Honor. If you look at Article 5, Section 21 and 22, that only comes from the legislature. And control is not enough here. And my main argument isn't that they don't meet the control test. Well, that is my third argument. That one provision that says that they have the veto power by requiring fees. But my first argument is that applies to the due process analysis, where it is state law that allows the state to hire outside counsel with a contingency fee, then you have to meet the due process test. I'm saying here, there is no law that allows them to do it. There's a law that prohibits them from doing it. Plus, control test doesn't work when you're dealing with penalties versus compensatory damages. The real question in this case is what policy should be adopted. Who adopts the policy? And that's the legislature. The Constitution says that. The legislature sets out the powers of the Attorney General. The legislature apportions the funds necessary. They're coming in here saying they don't have the budget to do this case. But the remedy is really in the legislature, and the legislature has spoken. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you very much. This case is being submitted, and will be in recess until the next call of the court.